A new industry is spawning in an old steel region. I'm Julie Grant, sitting in for Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, Shell's new ethane cracker in Beaver County is getting cheers for economic development, but jeers from those concerned about air pollution.
Adding the cracker brings the level of VOCs released to levels greater than what was seen in 1999.
Also, we'll answer one of the burning questions about Shell's project. What the heck is an ethane cracker? And a new environmental center opens in Pittsburgh, one of the only public buildings in the world to meet the Living Building Challenge. Those and more environmental stories coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. With the political season moving into full swing, coal country is getting some attention from the presidential candidates. Republican nominee Donald Trump has promised to bring back coal, with few details on how he plans to do that. Democrat Hillary Clinton has said she'd put miners out of work, but she's also pushing a big plan to reinvest in coal communities. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick visits southwestern Pennsylvania's Greene County to talk with people about the race.
Every year, the King Coal Parade winds through the center of Carmichael's, a small town about an hour south of Pittsburgh. People line up to see the fire engines, classic cars, floats, and marching bands. This year, at least, some are arguing about the election.
Oh, the coal industry! Guess who ain't for coal?
I think, you know what,
you want
the
who
coal industry
coal?
Was been around here for a long time.
And you know who ain't for it?
It's fair to say the presidential race has people pretty fired up and worried. That's because times are changing. Just ask 17-year-old Morgan Voighthofer, who was crowned coal queen in the annual pageant. She says she's thinking about moving away to pursue a career in acting.
People have been losing their jobs and many of the mines have been shutting down.
Over the past 4 years, Pennsylvania's lost about 3,000 jobs in the coal industry as it faces tougher environmental regulations and competition from cheaper natural gas and renewable energy. The downturn has hurt people like Raymond Beckett, a mine electrician who lost his job in March.
It's been a tough year, yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm 52 years old, and where am I going to find a job? Nobody even wants to look at me.
His unemployment is running out soon, and he doesn't know what's next.
This is all this area is known. It's coal and steel.
A lifelong Democrat, Beckett says he switched his registration to Republican before the primary to vote for Donald Trump, who he calls the lesser of two evils.
I don't think he'll be worse than anybody else that's been in there.
Greene County has been shifting from blue to red. In 2000, Al Gore beat George W. Bush by 10 points here. But the county has gone for Republican presidential candidates since then. There are a lot of Trump yard signs around now, which isn't surprising because he's been courting votes from coal communities across the country. Here he is at a rally in Kentucky.
We're going to bring the coal industry back, folks. We're going to bring it back.
Trump doubts the mainstream science about man-made climate change. He wants to roll back environmental regulations and lift a moratorium on new coal leases for federal land. When asked in Greene County if they really believe he can bring back coal, people often react with anger toward Clinton. Trump supporter Angela Smith is the daughter of a retired miner.
I mean, I think that if he can't, he can't. But he's willing to try. Hillary's like, let's just close down the coal mines.
Another guy leaned into the microphone but didn't want to give his name.
If Donald Duck was running for president against Hillary, I would vote for Donald Duck. I don't have any use for her, period.
A lot of people are mad about a comment Clinton made earlier this year.
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business, right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people.
She later apologized, saying that's not what she meant. But Clinton does think climate change is a real threat, and she's put together a $30 billion plan to reinvest in coal communities, which includes expanding clean energy projects and retraining workers. Her message has resonated with Don Fike, who lives in Carmichael's but skips the King Coal Parade. He's an ex-Marine and former coal miner going back to school under the GI Bill. He wishes others could use it too.
Coal miners are some of the most innovative people you ever meet. So I think that they do need a retraining program to help them out.
But perhaps not surprisingly, there is a fair amount of skepticism about presidential candidates promising to help.
They're talking about it now, but it should have been talked about 5, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
That's Greene County Commissioner Blair Zimmerman. A former miner himself, he's a Democrat supporting Clinton, but says both parties have let down coal country over the years.
Coal is hanging on, but by a thin thread.
Zimmerman thinks coal is still king, for now, just barely, and hopes the region can develop a more diverse economy in the future. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's just a short drive north to former steel country, Beaver County, and things are looking a lot different. Many are celebrating the announcement of new energy jobs at Shell's ethane cracker, a spinoff of the natural gas industry. The new plant is expected to bring 6,000 construction jobs to western Pennsylvania and 600 permanent ones once it's built. The cracker will use the byproducts of natural gas production to make 1.6 million tons of plastic a year. But how will that affect air quality? The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier looks at why some worry Shell's big project will bring pollution back to Pittsburgh.
Jim Fabizak is an environmental health scientist at the University of Pittsburgh. From his desk overlooking the Monongahela River, Fabizak pulls out a sheet of paper with a simple line graph on it.
Show you at least one piece of data.
The graph shows the amount of industrial pollution in Beaver County for volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. These are a broad class of chemicals that help form ground-level ozone, or smog.
And there's a steady improvement. So from 1999 to current, there's been about a 50% reduction in VOC released by industry over time. Okay, significant progress in air quality.
But beginning in 2016, the line on Fabizak's paper starts to go up and up until the year 2021. That's when Shell's ethane cracker is slated to come online in Beaver County.
Adding the cracker to this point in time, moving forward, brings the level of VOCs released in Beaver County by industrial sources to levels greater than what was seen in 1999.
In fact, with a projected 500-plus tons emitted per year, the plant would be the largest source of VOC pollution in western Pennsylvania, per EPA records. And it would be the third largest source in the entire state, behind an oil refinery in Philadelphia and a styrofoam plant in Reading. The next largest nearby VOC polluter is the Clairton Coke Works, checking in at 336 tons a year. In addition to this, the plant is classified as a major source of hazardous air pollutants, like benzene and formaldehyde, which can cause cancer and other serious health problems. Fabizak says these emissions are a concern, in particular because Pittsburgh's air already fails to meet federal standards for several pollutants, including ozone. But Shell and state officials say the cracker isn't a threat to public health. Mark Gorog is head of the air quality program for the Pittsburgh Regional Office of the State Department of Environmental Protection. He says since the Pittsburgh metro area doesn't meet federal air standards, Shell is installing modern pollution controls and a leak detection system in the plant itself.
So, you know, the technology that they install has to meet the latest and greatest, basically.
In addition, the company had to show the DEP that its plant wouldn't make the air unhealthy in surrounding areas.
You know, basically, they modeled to show they will not cause or contribute to an exceedance of the national ambient air quality standards, and they did a risk assessment for air toxics, which showed there was not going to be an undue risk to the public.
On top of these measures, the company will buy more than 1,000 tons of pollution offsets to make up for emissions that will come from its smokestacks, storage tanks, and flares. These offsets are called emissions reductions credits, or ERCs. These ERCs work kind of like a cap and trade system. The theory is that Shell will pay a different company to clean up emissions at another facility by buying credits from a plant that's either closing or installing pollution controls. But under state law, Shell is allowed to buy credits from plants that are already closed. Fabizak says this means pollution that's been gone from the region will be coming back in the form of emissions from the cracker plant.
I don't see that as improving the air quality to any great extent. It's like 3 steps forward, 2.99 steps back.
For instance, the company is buying 70 tons of credits from First Energy for two coal-fired power plant units it closed in Armstrong County in 2012. It's also buying 100 tons of credits from First Energy's closed Mitchell Power Plant in Washington County, which ceased operations in 2013. Fabizak says the best way for the system to work is if Shell would buy credits for future cuts to pollution, for, say, a company investing in pollution reductions at a power plant.
If everyone's still staying in the area and operating, over time that results in slow decreases in the amounts of emissions over time.
The DEP, which approved Shell's plan, doesn't see a problem with how the pollution credit system is working. By state law, plants that close have 10 years to sell their emissions credits. Gorog says new plants have to buy about 15% more credits than they will actually emit. So if Shell wants to emit 100 tons of pollution, it'll have to buy credits for 115 tons. This means that gradually emissions will go down, Gorog says.
You know, there's a certain pool of pollutants for the area, and gradually over time it shrinks. So, you know, over time, what the design does is, you know, shrink the pool of emissions, bring the area into attainment.
This won't happen overnight. The DEP's plans call for the region's air to meet federal guidelines within 5 years. Krishnan Ramamurthy, acting director of DEP's Bureau of Air Quality, says there's another aspect of the credit program. It incentivizes companies to clean up.
Because emission reduction credits are is a value, cash value. So particularly certain, is the supply and demand.
And if demand goes up for new plants to be built alongside the Shell plant, for instance, then the price of the credits will go up too and could encourage companies to close older, dirtier plants.
So they can really put additional controls to justify the control cost by selling some of the emission reduction credit in the program.
Shell, in an emailed statement, declined to say how much it's spending on its emissions credits, but emphasized the plant was built on the site of an old zinc smelting plant, which had a heavy environmental impact of its own. Some of Shell's credits, in fact, came from that plant, which closed in 2014. With or without Shell's ethane cracker, DEP officials admit it won't be easy for Pittsburgh to meet federal air standards in the near future. That's because last year, the EPA enacted stricter rules for ozone. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
And coming up next, we'll look a little closer at the process of turning ethane into a plastic bag. 12 years ago, flooding ravaged the small river town of Etna near Pittsburgh. But they turned a catastrophe into an opportunity.
This is an old steel mill town, and people think that that's something that can't be changed, but it really can.
Later on the Allegheny Front, how residents are drying out and reinventing their town with rain gardens and other green infrastructure. Stay tuned. Shell's ethane cracker plant will take a byproduct of natural gas drilling and turn it into the building blocks of plastics. They'll go into everything from water bottles to medical devices. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier wanted to find out how they do it.
You might be wondering, what is ethane and what is an ethane cracker? To answer this question for myself, I paid a visit to this guy.
Hi.
How you doing?
Reed. Nice to meet you.
Yeah. Guts Faeser is a chemist at the University of Pittsburgh's Swanson School of Engineering. He explained ethane is found with oil and natural gas underground. At normal temperatures and pressures, it's a gas. And it comes from the same place that oil and natural gas do, fossils.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's old organic mass. I mean, as we always joke, it's dinosaurs, right? I mean, it's old, it's plants, animals from geological times.
There is a lot of ethane in the deep shale formations in western Pennsylvania. It's a simple chain of two carbon atoms surrounded by six hydrogen atoms.
And ethane itself is not a very useful chemical, which is why it is being sent to the so-called cracker.
Before it even gets to the plant, the ethane gets separated from methane. That's the main component of natural gas, the stuff that heats your furnace and burns on your stovetop. At the cracker, the ethane gets put into tubes and heated up to around 1,500 degrees.
So as you heat it up, you basically make this molecule wiggle around more and more wildly.
As the molecule wiggles around more and more, the bonds holding its atoms together stretch and get weaker.
You can almost imagine it like when you have two kids that kind of hold arms and swing each other around. I mean, if they get too crazy and too wild, at some point they just can't hold onto each other anymore and fly apart. Sort of the same thing in a molecule here.
This is the cracking part of the cracker. When the molecular bonds fly apart, the atoms rearrange themselves into something new called ethylene. The two carbon atoms form a double bond with one another in this ethylene molecule. And this double bond is the key to why ethylene is so valuable.
And this double bond is very reactive. And that makes ethylene an extremely useful and very, very widely used chemical.
Ethylene reacts very easily with other chemicals, so it can be strung together in long chains.
You basically take many of these double bonded molecules and you use the double bond to connect them together, like Lego pieces.
And when you snap all these ethylenes together, you get polyethylene. This is the ubiquitous plastic found in everything from milk containers to medical devices to detergents. You name it.
You find it in medical equipment, in hospitals. You find it in the food packaging industry. I mean, it's hard. It's almost impossible to imagine modern life without ethylene derivatives.
And Shell's ethane cracker will be one place where all these facets of modern life start to form. Made from a gas found deep underground. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Pittsburgh's Frick Park boasts over 600 acres of woodland, fields, and wetlands in the middle of the city. In 2002, a fire destroyed the park's Environmental Education Center. The Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy and the city are now unveiling a new center. The new building is one of only a handful in the world to meet the Living Building Challenge. It's a rigorous certification for green buildings. It'll also house education programs for school kids and families, and it officially opens to the public this weekend. The Allegheny Front's Carol Holsoppel got a sneak peek late last fall when construction was still underway. She met with Marika Hecht, the project manager at the time, to find out more.
I like to start at the gatehouses because it's a great reminder that Frick Park is a designed landscape.
They're old-fashioned. They kind of look like a lot of the houses in this neighborhood.
Yeah, your sense that they remind you of the neighborhood is great because that's exactly what the designers were thinking about. They wanted you to come through this feeling of neighborhood into a formal landscape. And then the idea was that you would move through this formal space into a more wild space, which is exactly how Frick Park feels. When you're walking through, you can easily forget that it was designed to be this way.
So we're standing between these two stone gates, but we're looking towards this very modern building.
We worked really closely with the community at large, then ended up working with about 1,000 people over the course of quite a lengthy design process to really understand what did people want. And of course, everyone wants different things, but we wanted to make sure that this historic landscape didn't get overshadowed by the building. So you can see from this angle, when you're here up at the gatehouses, the building really looks like a one-story building. But as we walk around the site, you'll see it's actually a three-story building, the upper portion of which is completely public.
Well, let me just ask, this building is meant to meet the Living Building Challenge. What are some of the requirements and how will you meet them?
The Living Building Challenge is a challenge. It's well named. It has pedals that describe the different categories that you need to work in. For example, water is a pedal, and energy is a pedal, and materials is a pedal. But it's different than LEED certification, where there's a checklist of things. You really need to wrestle with these requirements. So for example, with water, you have to be net zero water. So you have to demonstrate that you can capture as much water as you need to use, that any additional water is getting infiltrated into the ground, that you're able to actually treat all of your sewage on site. All of the techniques that we use, we try to be as simple as possible. So nothing that you're going to see here today is that experimental, believe it or not, because we wanted to show that this is possible and reproducible.
You want to show me some of these things we're talking about?
Yeah, let's do it. We're actually walking right now over our geothermal field. So when you come to visit the site, you will see this beautiful rows of trees, but underneath there are actually 18 geothermal wells that are 520 feet into the ground, and they are all connected, and they're able to take advantage of the natural 55 degrees underground temperature, bring that temperature into the building. That gets then transferred through our ground source heat pump, which then feeds our radiant floor heat in the building. This is cool. So we're walking into the building on bridges, and you'll be walking kind of at the top of the trees, and you get a sense of that here already as we're looking out. And I wanted to stop here because this is a great place to talk about water. We will be net zero water, so we'll be capturing and reusing water on site. We'll also be infiltrating water into the ground. Maybe more excitingly, we'll be celebrating water here. We want people to be inspired and excited by the natural world. So this building actually will shed all of the water off the north side in a rain veil. It'll be like a waterfall coming off the front side of the building, and then that'll wrap around. So rainwater will actually flood through this art piece, and then that water will go down. You can see there's two sets of steps. One set of steps is for the water. They're rainwater steps. So you have to come when it's raining. And our hope is that on a rainy day, kids will wake up and say, hey, let's go to the Frick Environmental Center because something special is happening at the Frick Environmental Center.
There should be plenty of days for that. Yay. In our summers here in Pittsburgh.
Exactly. I think that's part of the point, right? We get over 40 inches of rain a year in Pittsburgh, and we tend to feel bummed out when it rains, but we want people to really see this water as the resource that it truly is and have it be very visible. I think that maybe the coolest thing about the Frick Environmental Center in some ways is that this is a very advanced building that belongs to all of us, that will be free, open to the public, and there's the construction happening right now.
The construction must go on.
The construction must go on. All right, so this is the moment.
We're going inside. Oh, it's a lot warmer in here.
Why don't we walk this way a little bit? So now we're looking back north. The reason I wanted to show you this side is you can just see this wall of windows right in front of us is where that rain veil will be. So when it's raining, you'll see just a sheet of water coming down here.
Very cool. And it's so light.
So light. That's another one of those strategies for energy. The less we need to turn on interior lights, the less electricity that we'll need. And actually, the lights have sensors so that lights that are closer to the window will shut off earlier than lights that are farther away from the window. This is really important, too. Everyone wanted windows, but we also know that birds hit windows and die. So we've tried to do a couple of things just in the building design that will help with that by having the windows recessed. The truth is it's really hard to meet people's hopes and then also really be thinking about how that impacts wildlife.
So now we're back outside.
So we're walking down a way that you won't actually ultimately be able to walk. This will all be planted out. We're gonna just kind of tuck underneath this Eastern Bridge. I love this view of the building. To me, it just, the contrast is so different from the front. All of the columns are very regular. Like, we have columns that are running through the gallery in the building. We have columns on the bridge, and they're very evenly spaced. It's very formal. The architects thought, well, on this side, what if we made the columns a little irregular, like the trees are in the woodlands? So you can see they're not perfectly spaced. They're spaced where they need to be from a structural perspective, but there's also some thought about what's the feeling that things give us when there's a little irregularity to it? How does that change your impression of a space? And how can the building mirror what's happening outside in the landscape as well as possible?
That was the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple talking with Marijke Hecht last fall. At the time, Hecht was director of education at the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. She also happens to be married to our show's energy reporter, Reed Frazier. We have photos and a schedule of events at the new Frick Environmental Center over at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. One of the bigger challenges river communities face is flooding. Some flooding is natural along rivers, but when trees and meadows are replaced by hard surfaces like parking lots and roads, it can, of course, make floods worse, especially during big storms. Producer Lou Bluen visited a river town along the Allegheny River just outside of Pittsburgh, where a third of the community lies in a floodplain. And they're gaining national attention for their use of green infrastructure.
Hi, I'm Mary Ellen Ramage, and I am the borough manager of Etna, Pennsylvania. Etna is a fabulous community. We are a former steel mill town, And I like to say we are a community of survivors. Over the years, we've had some devastating floods, but 2004 was a devastating flood. It was the aftermath of Hurricane Ivan, and we had 400 residents who were flooded, which is basically 25% of the community. And it really was a pivotal moment where immediately after the flood, we got together and we said, you know, we got to do something about this. So we actually adopted a green master plan for the entire community that identifies around 28 projects that attack and manage our stormwater. Okay, let me take you on a little tour. Here we are at the Etna Borough Swimming Pool and Park and Playground, and please excuse the noise. We have a crane here doing some work on our camera system for the playground, but I'm standing in front of our swimming pool bathhouse where we have this massive water rain garden that we installed in 2014. And there's a great sign that explains how it filters out all the dirt of the water and puts it back into the ground in a natural way. And before we put it up, it was really cool. This was just a grassy area, and we had all these signs up that had umbrellas on it, and it said rain garden coming. And we had so many people call, and they're like, you're collecting rain? How do you make a garden out of rain? So it's just one of our greatest educational tools, and it captures a younger audience, which I think is very important. And here we are. This is Walnut Street. This parking lot is a little public parking lot we have to supplement, you know, off-street parking in our business district, and we decided it needed rehab, and so we were just going to pave it because it really was kind of an eyesore. We thought, well, we can't do that. We have an opportunity here, you know, because you have to fix something or you have to change something. That's the golden moment to try to do it the right way. So we dug this whole parking lot up. It's actually 1.1 acres. Of drainage that this little parking lot captures through this rain garden. And then the water goes into this storm grate, and then it naturally goes into the infiltration bed underground. So now this one parking lot is not just a parking lot, it's a huge stormwater management practice. It manages over 500,000 gallons of stormwater a year for our system. You know, we're really good here in Etna, I think, of saying, all right, what are our problems and how can we deal with them and what can we do? But I don't think we do a good job at letting other people know what we're doing. Mostly it's just that we're just so busy doing it. You know, we just keep moving along. You know, like I said, this is an old steel mill town, and people think that that's something that can't be changed, but it really can. You know, when I first took this position, the term river town kind of had a very negative connotation on it. You know, it kind of meant, oh, those are the poor people in the floodplain and that. And now being a river town is like such a cool thing to be because people want to be able to live by the water. We just need to recognize the asset that we have and do what we can to protect the asset that we have.
That was Mary Ellen Ramage, the borough manager of Etna, a river town outside of Pittsburgh. Etna was recognized by the Environmental Protection Agency for its efforts to keep waterways cleaner. More on that and other audio postcards in the series at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. Kara Holsoppel will be back next week. I'm Julie Grant.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.